Chapter 18. Flow. The Genius of Routine. Routine, in an intelligent man, is a sign of ambition. W. H. Auden. For years before the Olympic swimmer Michael Phelps won the gold at the 2008 Beijing Olympics, he followed the same routine at every race. He arrived 2 hours early. He stretched and loosened up according to a precise pattern. 800 mixer, 50 freestyle, 600 kicking with kickboard, 400 pulling a boy, and more. After the warm-up, he would dry off, put in his earphones, and sit, never lie down, on the massage table. From that moment, he and his coach, Bob Bowman, wouldn't speak a word to each other until after the race was over. At 45 minutes before the race, he would put on his race suit. At 30 minutes, he would get into the warm-up pool and do 600 to 800 meters. With 10 minutes to go, he would walk to the ready room. He would find a seat alone, never next to anyone. He liked to keep the seats on both sides of him clear for his things, goggles on one side and his towel on the other. When his race was called, he would walk to the blocks. There he would do what he always did, two stretches. First a straight leg stretch, and then with a bent knee. Left leg first every time, then the right earbud would come out. When his name was called, he would take out the left earbud. He would step onto the block, always from the left side. He would dry the block every time. Then he would stand and flap his arms in such a way that his hands hit his back. Phelps explains, "It's just a routine, my routine. It's the routine I've gone through my whole life. I'm not going to change it." And that is that. His coach, Bob Bowman, designed this physical routine with Phelps. But that's not all. He also gave Phelps a routine for what to think about as he went to sleep and first thing when he awoke. He called it watching the videotape. There was no actual tape, of course. The tape was a visualization of the perfect race. In exquisite detail and slow motion, Phelps would visualize every moment from his starting position on top of the blocks through each stroke until he emerged from the pool victorious with water dripping off his face. Phelps didn't do this mental routine occasionally. He did it every day before he went to bed and every day when he woke up for years. When Bob wanted to challenge him in practices, he would shout, "Put in the videotape!" And Phelps would push beyond his limits. Eventually, the mental routine was so deeply ingrained that Bob barely had to whisper the phrase, "Get the videotape ready," before a race, and Phelps was already ready to hit play. When asked about the routine, Bowman said, "If you were to ask Michael what's going on in his head before competition, he would say he's not really thinking about anything. He's just following the program. But that's not right. It's more like his habits have taken over. When the race arrives, he's more than halfway through his plan, and he's been victorious at every step. All the stretches went like he planned. The warm-up laps were just like he visualized. His headphones are playing exactly what he expected. The actual race is just another step in a pattern that started earlier that day and has been nothing but victories. Winning is a natural extension." As we all know, Phelps won the record 8 gold medals at the 2008 Beijing Olympics. When visiting Beijing years after Phelps' breathtaking accomplishment, I couldn't help but think about how Phelps and the other Olympians make all these feats of amazing athleticism seem so effortless. Of course, Olympic athletes arguably practice longer and train harder than any other athletes in the world. But when they get in that pool, or on that track, or onto that rink, they make it look positively easy. It's more than just a natural extension of their training. It's a testament to the genius of the right routine. The way of the non-essentialist is to think the essentials only get done when they are forced. That execution is a matter of raw effort alone. You labor to make it happen. You push through. The way of the essentialist is different. The essentialist designs a routine that makes achieving what you have identified as essential the default position. Yes, in some instances, an essentialist still has to work hard, but with the right routine in place, each effort yields exponentially greater results. A non-essentialist tries to execute the essentials by force. An essentialist designs a routine that enshrines what is essential, making execution almost effortless. A non-essentialist allows non-essentials to be the default. An essentialist makes the essential the default position. Making it look easy. Routine is one of the most powerful tools for removing obstacles. Without routine, the pool of non-essential distractions will overpower us. But if we create a routine that enshrines the essentials, we will begin to execute them on autopilot. Instead of our consciously pursuing the essential, it will happen without our having to think about it. We won't have to expend precious energy every day prioritizing everything. We must simply expend a small amount of initial energy to create the routine, and then all that is left to do is follow it. There is a huge body of scientific research to explain the mechanism by which routine enables difficult things to become easy. One simplified explanation is that as we repeatedly do a certain task, the neurons, or nerve cells, make new connections through communication gateways called synapses. With repetition, the connections strengthen, and it becomes easier for the brain to activate them. For example, when you learn a new word, it takes several repetitions at various intervals for the word to be mastered. To recall the word later, you will need to activate the same synapses until eventually you know the word without consciously thinking about it. A similar process explains how, when we drive from point A to point B every day, we can eventually make the journey without consciously thinking about it, or why, once we've cooked the same meal a few times, we no longer have to consult the recipe, or why any mental task gets easier and easier each time we attempt it. With repetition, the routine is mastered and the activity becomes second nature. Our ability to execute the essential improves with practice, just like any other ability. Think about the first time you had to perform a certain critical function at work. At first, you felt like a novice. You probably felt unsure and awkward. The effort to focus drained your willpower. Decision fatigue set in. You were probably easily distracted. This is perfectly normal. But once you performed the function over and over, you gained confidence. You were no longer sidetracked. You were able to perform the function better and faster, and with less concentration and effort. This power of a routine grows out of our brain's ability to take over entirely until the process becomes fully unconscious. There is another cognitive advantage to routine as well. Once the mental work shifts to the basal ganglia, mental space is freed up to concentrate on something new. This allows us to autopilot the execution of one essential activity while simultaneously actively engaging in another, without sacrificing our level of focus or contribution. In fact, the brain starts working less and less, says Charles Duhigg, author of the book The Power of Habit. The brain can almost completely shut down, and this is a real advantage because it means you have all of this mental activity you can devote to something else. To some, routine can sound like where creativity and innovation go to die, the ultimate exercise in boredom. We even use the word as a synonym for pallid and bland, as in, it has just become routine for me. And routines can indeed become this, the wrong routines. But the right routines can actually enhance innovation and creativity by giving us the equivalent of an energy rebate. Instead of spending our limited supply of discipline on making the same decisions again and again, embedding our decisions into our routine allows us to channel that discipline towards some other essential activity. The work Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi has done on creativity demonstrates how highly creative people use strict routines to free up their minds. Most creative individuals find out early what their best rhythms are for sleeping, eating, and working, and abide by them even when it is tempting to do otherwise, Mihaly says. They wear clothes that are comfortable, they interact only with people they find congenial, they do only things they think are important. Of course, such idiosyncrasies are not endearing to those they have to deal with, but personalizing patterns of action helps to free the mind from the expectations that make demands on attention and allows intense concentration on matters that count. One CEO in one of Silicon Valley's most innovative companies has what at first glance would seem like a boring, creativity-killing routine. He holds a three-hour meeting that starts at 9 a.m. one day a week. It is never missed. It is never rescheduled at a different time. It is mandatory, so much so that even in this global firm, all the executives know never to schedule any travel that will conflict with the meeting. If it is 9 a.m. on Monday, every person will be there. It is a discipline. At first blush, there is nothing particularly unique about this. But what is unique is the quality of ideas that come out of this regular meeting. Because the CEO has eliminated the mental cost involved in planning the meeting or thinking about who will or won't be there. People can focus on the creative problem solving. And indeed, his team makes coming up with creative, inventive ideas and solutions look natural and easy. The power of the right routine. According to researchers at Duke University, nearly 40% of our choices are deeply unconscious. We don't think about them in the usual sense. There is both danger and opportunity in this. The opportunity is that we can develop new abilities that eventually become instinctive. The danger is that we may develop routines that are counterproductive. Without being fully aware, we can get caught in non-essential habits, like checking our email the second we get out of bed every morning, or picking up a donut on the way home from work each day, or spending our lunch hour trolling the internet instead of using the time to think, reflect, recharge, or connect with friends and colleagues. So how can we discard the routines that keep us locked in non-essential habits and replace them with routines that make executing essentials almost effortless? Overhaul your triggers. Most of us have a behavioral habit we want to change, whether it's to eat less junk food, waste less time, or worry less. But when we try, we find that changing even the simplest, tiniest habit is amazingly, disturbingly hard. There seems to be a gravitational force pulling us inexorably back to the warm embrace of those French fries, that website with the pictures of the goofy cats, or the spiral of worry about things outside our control. How do we resist the powerful pull of these habits? In an interview about his book, The Power of Habit, Charles Duhigg said, "In the last 15 years, as we've learned how habits work and how they can be changed, scientists have explained that every habit is made up of a cue, a routine, and a reward. The cue is a trigger that tells your brain to go into automatic mode and which habit to use. Then there is the routine, the behavior itself, which can be physical or mental or emotional. Finally, there is a reward, which helps your brain figure out if this particular habit is worth remembering for the future. Over time, this loop, cue, routine, reward, cue, routine, reward, becomes more automatic as the cue and reward become neurologically intertwined. What this means is that if we want to change our routine, we don't really need to change the behavior. Rather, we need to find the cue that is triggering the non-essential activity, or behavior, and find a way to associate that same cue with something that is essential. So, for example, if the bakery you pass on the way home from work triggers you to pick up a donut, next time you pass by the bakery, use that cue to remind you to pick up a salad from the deli across the street. Or if your alarm clock going off in the morning triggers you to check your email, use it as a cue to get up and read instead. At first, overcoming the temptation to stop at the bakery or check the email will be difficult. But each time you execute the new behavior, each time you pick up the salad, strengthens the link in your brain between the cue and the new behavior, and soon you'll be subconsciously and automatically performing the new routine. Create new triggers. If the goal is to create some behavioral change, we're not just confined to our existing cues. We can create brand new ones to trigger the execution of some essential routine. I used this technique to develop the daily routine of writing in a journal, and it worked wonders for me. For a long time, I wrote in my journal only sporadically. I would put it off all day, and then at night I would rationalize, "I will do it in the morning." But inevitably I wouldn't, and then by the next night I had 2 days' worth to write, and it was overwhelming. so I put it off again, and so on. Then I heard someone say he had developed a routine of writing a few lines at the exact same time each day. This seemed like a manageable habit, but I knew that I would need some cue reminding me to write at the specified time each day, or I would continue to put it off as I'd been doing. So I started putting my journal in my bag right next to my phone. That way, when I pulled my phone out of my bag to charge it each evening, already a well-established habit, I see the journal, and this cues me to write in it. Now it is instinctive, natural. I look forward to it. It has been 10 years now, and I have almost never missed a day. Do the most difficult thing first. Ray Zinn is the founder and CEO of Micrel, a semiconductor business in Silicon Valley. He is a contrarian in lots of ways. He is 75 years old in an industry and city that usually celebrates 20-year-old college dropouts. In 1978, he and his business partner invested $300,000 to launch the company, and it has been profitable every single year since inception, except for 1 year when they consolidated two manufacturing facilities. Since going public, their stock price has never fallen below its IPO price. Ray credits this success to their highly disciplined focus on profitability. He has led the company as CEO for 35 years, and throughout that period, Ray has followed an extraordinarily consistent routine. He wakes up at 5:30 a.m. every single morning, including Saturday and Sunday, as he's done for more than 50 years. He then exercises for an hour. He eats breakfast at 7:30 a.m. and arrives at work at 8:15 a.m. Dinner is at 6:30 p.m. with his family. Bedtime is 10 p.m. But what really enables Ray to operate at his highest level of contribution is that throughout the day, his routine is governed by a single rule: focus on the hardest thing first. After all, as Ray said to me, we already have too much to think about. Why not eliminate some of them by establishing a routine? Use the tips above to develop a routine of doing your hardest task in the day first thing in the morning. Find a cue, whether it's that first glass of orange juice you have at your desk, or an alarm you set on your cell phone, or anything you're already accustomed to doing first thing in the morning, to trigger you to sit down and focus on your hardest thing. Mix up your routines. It's true that doing the same things at the same time, day after day, can get boring. To avoid this kind of routine fatigue, there's no reason why you can't have different routines for different days of the week. Jack Dorsey, the co-founder of Twitter and founder of Square, has an interesting approach to his weekly routine. He's divided up his week into themes. Monday is for management meetings and running the company work. Tuesday is for product development. Wednesday is for marketing, communications, and growth. Thursday is for developers and partnerships. Friday is for the company and its culture. This routine helps to provide calmness amid the chaos of a high-growth startup. It enables him to focus his energy on a single theme each day instead of feeling pulled into everything. He adheres to this routine each week, no exceptions, and over time people learn this about him and can organize meetings and requests around it. Tackle your routines one by one. It would be unfortunate to become so taken with the genius of routine that we'd be tempted to try to overhaul multiple routines at the same time. But as we learned in the last chapter, to get big results, we must start small. So start with one change in your daily or weekly routine and then build on your progress from there. I don't want to imply that any of this is easy. Many of our non-essential routines are deep and emotional. They have been formed in the furnace of some strong emotions. The idea that we can just snap our fingers and replace them with a new one is naive. Learning essential new skills is never easy. But once we master them and make them automatic, we have won an enormous victory, because the skill remains with us for the rest of our lives. The same is true with routines. Once they are in place, they are gifts that keep on giving. Chapter 19. Focus. What's important now? Life is available only in the present moment. If you abandon the present moment, you cannot live the moments of your daily life deeply. Thich Nhat Hanh. Larry Gelwicks coached the Highland High School rugby team to 418 wins with only 10 losses and 20 national championships over 36 years. He describes his success this way: "We always win." With a record like Highland's, he has the right to make the statement. But he is actually referring to something more than his winning record. When he says win, he's also referring to a single question, with its apt acronym, that guides what he expects from his players. What's important now? By keeping his players fully present in the moment and fully focused on what is most important, not on next week's match or tomorrow's practice or the next play, but now, Gelwicks helps make winning almost effortless. But how? First, the players apply the question constantly throughout the game. Instead of getting caught up rehashing the last play that went wrong, or spending their mental energy worrying about whether they are going to lose the game, neither of which is helpful or constructive, Larry encourages them to focus only on the play they are in right now. Second, the question, "What's important now?" helps them stay focused on how they are playing. Larry believes a huge part of winning is determined by whether the players are focused on their own game or on their opponent's game. If the players start thinking about the other team, they lose focus. Consciously or not, they start wanting to play the way the other team is playing. They get distracted and divided. By focusing on their game in the here and now, they can all unite around a single strategy. This level of unity makes execution of their game plan relatively frictionless. Indeed, Larry has a fundamentally essentialist approach to winning and losing. As he tells his players, there is a difference between losing and being beaten. Being beaten means they are better than you. They are faster, stronger, and more talented. To Larry, losing means something else. It means you lost focus. It means you didn't concentrate on what was essential. It is all based on a simple but powerful idea. To operate at your highest level of contribution requires that you deliberately tune in to what is important in the here and now. There is only now. Think about how this might apply in your own life. Have you ever become trapped reliving past mistakes, over and over like a video player, stuck on endless replay? Do you spend time and energy worrying about the future? Do you spend more time thinking about things you can't control rather than the things you can control, about the areas where your efforts matter? Do you ever find yourself busy trying to mentally prepare for the next meeting, or the next assignment, or the next chapter in your life, rather than being fully present in the current one? It's natural and human to obsess over past mistakes or feel stress about what may be ahead of us. Yet every second spent worrying about a past or future moment distracts us from what is important in the here and now. The ancient Greeks had two words for time. The first was Chronos. The second was Kairos. The Greek god Chronos was imagined as an elderly, grey-haired man, and his name connotes the literal ticking clock, the chronological time, the kind we measure and race about trying to use efficiently. Kairos is different. While it is difficult to translate precisely, it refers to time that is opportune, right, different. Chronos is quantitative. Kairos is qualitative. The latter is experienced only when we are fully in the moment, when we exist in the now. It is mind-bending to consider that in practical terms we only ever have now. We can't control the future in a literal sense, just the now. Of course, we learn from the past and can imagine the future, yet only in the here and now can we actually execute on the things that really matter. Non-essentialists tend to be so preoccupied with past successes and failures, as well as future challenges and opportunities, that they miss the present moment. They become distracted, unfocused. They aren't really there. The way of the essentialist is to tune into the present, to experience life in Kairos, not just Chronos, to focus on the things that are truly important, not yesterday or tomorrow, but right now. The non-essentialist mind is spinning out about the past or the future. The essentialist mind is focused on the present. A non-essentialist thinks about what was important yesterday or tomorrow. An essentialist tunes in to what is important right now. A non-essentialist worries about the future or stresses about the past. An essentialist enjoys the moment. Recently, Anna and I met for lunch in the middle of a busy workday. Usually, when we meet for lunch, we're so busy catching each other up on the events of our mornings or planning the activities for the evening that we forget to enjoy the act of having lunch together in the here and now. So this time, as the food arrived, Anna suggested an experiment. We should focus only on the moment. No rehashing our morning meetings, no talking about who would pick up the children from karate, or what we'd cook for dinner that night. We should eat slowly and deliberately, fully focused on the present. I was totally game for it. As I slowly took my first bite, something happened. I noticed my breathing. Then, without conscious intent, I found it slowing. Suddenly, time itself felt as if it was moving slower. Instead of feeling as if my body was in one place and my mind was in five other places, I felt as though both my mind and my body were fully there. The sensation stayed with me into the afternoon, where I noticed another change. Instead of being interrupted by distracting thoughts, I was able to give my full concentration to my work, because I was calm and present on the tasks at hand. Each one flowed naturally. Instead of my usual state of having my mental energies split and scattered across many competing subjects, my state was one of being focused on the subject that was most important in the present. Getting my work done not only became more effortless, but actually gave me joy. In this case, what was good for the mind was also good for the soul. Jiro Ono is the world's greatest sushi chef, and the subject of the movie Dreams of Sushi, directed by David Gelb. At 85 years of age, he has been making sushi for decades, and indeed for him, the art of making sushi has become nearly effortless. Yet his isn't simply the story of how practice and experience lead to mastery. Watching him work, you see someone entirely in the moment. Essentialists live their whole lives in this manner, and because they do, they can apply their full energy to the job at hand. They don't diffuse their efforts with distractions. They know that execution is easy if you work hard at it, and hard if you work easy at it. Multitasking versus multifocusing. I ran into a former classmate of mine years after graduating from Stanford. I was on campus doing some work on a computer in one of the offices when he came over to me to say hi. After a minute of pleasantries, he told me he was in between jobs. He explained a little about the job he was looking for and asked if I could help him. I started asking him some questions to see how I could be helpful to him. But 20 seconds into the conversation, he got a text on his phone. Without saying a word, he looked down and started responding to it. I did what I typically do when that happens. I paused and waited. 10 seconds went by, then 20. I simply stood there as he continued to text away furiously. He didn't say anything. He didn't acknowledge me. Out of curiosity, I waited to see how long it would go on. But after 2 full minutes, which is quite a lot of time when you are standing waiting for someone, I gave up, walked back to my desk, and went back to my work. After another 5 minutes, he became present again, interrupting me for the second time. Now he wanted to resume the conversation, to ask for help with his job search again. Initially, I had been ready to recommend him for a job opening I knew of, but after this incident, I admit to feeling hesitant about recommending him for an interview where he might suddenly not be present. He'd be present in body, perhaps, but not in mind. At this point, you might expect me to start talking about the evils of multitasking, about how a true essentialist never attempts to do more than one thing at a time. But in fact, we can easily do two things at the same time. Wash the dishes and listen to the radio. Eat and talk. Clear the clutter on our desk while thinking about where to go for lunch. Text message while watching television, and so on. What we can't do is concentrate on two things at the same time. When I talk about being present, I'm not talking about doing only one thing at a time. I'm talking about being focused on one thing at a time. Multitasking is not the enemy of essentialism. Pretending we can multifocus is. How to be in the now. What can we do to be fully present on what is in front of us? Following are some simple techniques to consider. Figure out what is most important right now. Recently, I had taught a full day on essentialism to an executive team in New York. I'd thoroughly enjoyed the day and had felt present throughout. But by the time I returned to my room, I felt a sudden pull in a million directions. Everything around me was a reminder of all the things I could be doing. Check my email, listen to messages, read a book I felt obligated to read, prepare the presentation for a few weeks from now, record interesting ideas that had grown out of the day's experiences, and more. It wasn't just the sheer number of things that felt overwhelming. It was that familiar stress of many tasks vying for top billing at the same time. As I felt the anxiety and tension rise, I stopped. I knelt down, I closed my eyes and asked, "What's important now?" After a moment of reflection, I realized that until I knew what was important right now, what was important right now was to figure out what was important right now. I stood up, I tidied up, I put all the objects strewn around me away in their proper place so they wouldn't distract me and pressure me to do their bidding every time I walked by. I turned off my phone. It was such a relief to have a barrier between me and someone's ability to text me. I opened my journal and wrote about the day. It centered me. I wrote a list in pencil of all the things on my mind. Then I clarified this by asking, "What do you need to do to be able to go to sleep peacefully?" What was essential, I decided, was to connect with my wife and children. Then it was to do just those few things that would make the first few hours of the next morning as effortless as possible. Schedule a wake-up call and breakfast in the room. Get my slides loaded on the computer, iron my shirt. I crossed off the things that were not important right then. When faced with so many tasks and obligations that you can't figure out which to tackle first, stop. Take a deep breath. Get present in the moment and ask yourself, what is most important this very second? Not what's most important tomorrow or even an hour from now. If you're not sure, make a list of everything vying for your attention and cross off anything that is not important right now. Get the future out of your head. Getting the future out of your head enables you to more fully focus on what is important now. In this case, my next step was to sit down and list those things that might have been essential, just not right now. So I opened to another page in my journal. This time I asked myself, what might you want to do someday as a result of today? This was not a list of firm commitments, just a way to get all of the ideas out of my head and on paper. This had two purposes. First, it ensured I wouldn't forget about those ideas, which might prove useful later. Second, it alleviated that stressful and distracting feeling that I needed to act upon them right this second. Prioritize. After this, I prioritized each list. Then I worked on each item on the What is Essential Now list, one at a time. I just calmly worked through the list and erased each item when it was complete. By the time I went to sleep, I had not only done all the things that needed to be executed at that moment, but I had executed them better and faster because I was focused. The pause that refreshes. Jeffrey A. Rogers, an executive vice president, was once taught the simple idea of pausing to refresh. It began when Jeff realized that as he drove home from work each evening, his mind was still focused on work-related projects. We all know this feeling. We may have left the office physically, but we are very much still there mentally. As our minds get caught in the endless loop of replaying the events of today and worrying about all the things we need to get done the following day. So now, as he gets to the door of his house, he applies what he calls the pause that refreshes. This technique is easy. He stops for just a moment. He closes his eyes. He breathes in and out once, deeply and slowly. As he exhales, he lets the work issues fall away. This allows him to walk through the front door to his family with more singleness of purpose. It supports the sentiment attributed to Lao Tzu: in work, do what you enjoy. In family life, be completely present. Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Zen Buddhist monk, who has been called the world's calmest man, has spent a lifetime exploring how to live in Kairos, albeit by a different name. He has taught it as mindfulness or maintaining beginner's mind. He has written, "Mindfulness helps you go home to the present, and every time you go there and recognize a condition of happiness that you have, happiness comes." This focus on being in the moment affects the way he does everything. He takes a full hour to drink a cup of tea with the other monks every day. He explains, "Suppose you are drinking a cup of tea. When you hold your cup, you may like to breathe in, to bring your mind back to your body, and you become fully present. And when you are truly there, something else is also there, life, represented by the cup of tea. In that moment you are real, and the cup of tea is real. You are not lost in the past, in the future, in your projects, in your worries. You are free from all of these afflictions, and in that state of being free, you enjoy your tea. That is the moment of happiness and of peace." Pay attention through the day for your own Kairos moments. Write them down in your journal. Think about what triggered that moment and what brought you out of it. Now that you know what triggers the moment, try to recreate it. Training yourself to tune into Kairos will not only enable you to achieve a higher level of contribution, but also make you happier. Chapter 20. B. The Essentialist Life. Beware the barrenness of a busy life. Socrates. It all began while he was studying to become a barrister in England. With a wealthy family and good professional prospects, the future looked bright. Every day he woke up with a sense of certainty. He was clear on his main objective: to prepare to become a professional in law and then make a comfortable living. But then he took the opportunity to go on a journey around the world, and everything changed. Mohandas K. Gandhi went to South Africa and saw oppression there. Suddenly he found a higher purpose: the liberation of the oppressed everywhere. With this new singleness of purpose, he eliminated everything else from his life. He called the process reducing himself to zero. He dressed in his own homespun cloth, khadi, and inspired his followers to do the same. He spent 3 years not reading any newspapers because he found that their content added only non-essential confusion to his life. He spent 35 years experimenting with simplifying his diet. He spent a day each week without speaking. It would be an understatement to say he eschewed consumerism. When he died, he owned fewer than 10 items. More importantly, of course, he devoted his life to helping the people of India gain independence. He intentionally never held a political position of any kind, yet he became, officially within India, the father of the nation. But his contribution extended well beyond India. As General George C. Marshall, the American Secretary of State, said on the occasion of Gandhi's passing, "Mahatma Gandhi had become the spokesman for the conscience of mankind, a man who made humility and simple truth more powerful than empires." And Albert Einstein added, "Generations to come will scarce believe that such a one as this ever in flesh and blood walked upon this earth." It is impossible to argue with the statement that Gandhi lived a life that really mattered. Of course, we don't have to try to replicate Gandhi to benefit from his example as someone who lived fully and completely as an essentialist. We can all purge our lives of the non-essential and embrace the way of the essentialist in our own ways and in our own time and on our own scale. We can all live a life not just of simplicity, but of high contribution and meaning. Living essentially. There are two ways of thinking about essentialism. The first is to think of it as something you do occasionally. The second is to think of it as something you are. In the former, essentialism is one more thing to add to your already overstuffed life. In the latter, it is a different way, a simpler way, of doing everything. It becomes a lifestyle. It becomes an all-encompassing approach to living and leading. It becomes the essence of who we are. Essentialism has deep roots in many spiritual and religious traditions. Gautama Buddha left his life as a prince to seek the ascetic life. This led him to his enlightenment and the birth of Buddhism. Likewise, Judaism grew out of the story of Moses, leaving his opulent life as an adopted prince in Egypt to live in the wilderness as a sheepherder. It was there he encountered the burning bush and discovered his essential mission to bring the Israelites out of bondage. The Prophet Muhammad lived an essential life that included mending his own shoes and clothes, and milking his own goat, and taught his followers in Islam to do the same. John the Baptist, too, had the epitome of a simple lifestyle, living in the desert, wearing camel hair clothes, and eating off the land. Christian groups such as Quakers also maintained a staunchly essentialist element to their faith. For example, they practiced the testimony of simplicity, in which they committed to a life of only what was essential. And of course, Jesus lived as a carpenter, and then in his ministry lived without wealth, political position, or material belongings. We can see the philosophy of less but better reflected in the lives of other notable and diverse figures, both religious and secular, throughout history. To name a few, the Dalai Lama, Steve Jobs, Leo Tolstoy, Michael Jordan, Warren Buffett, Mother Teresa, and Henry David Thoreau, who wrote, "I do believe in simplicity. It is astonishing as well as sad how many trivial affairs even the wisest thinks he must attend to in a day. So simplify the problem of life. Distinguish the necessary and the real." Indeed, we can find essentialists among the most successful people in every type of human endeavor. These include religious leaders, journalists, politicians, lawyers, doctors, investors, athletes, authors, artists. These people make their greatest contribution in many different ways, but they share one trait. They don't just give lip service to the idea of less but better. They have deliberately chosen to fully embrace the way of the essentialist. Regardless of what job, field, or industry we are in, we can all choose to do the same. Hopefully, at this point in the book, you've learned and absorbed all the core tenets and skills of an essentialist. In this chapter, it's time to take the final step and learn how to use those skills not just to practice essentialism occasionally, but to become a true essentialist. Majoring in minor activities. There is a big difference between being a non-essentialist who happens to apply essentialist practices, and an essentialist who only occasionally slips back into some non-essentialist practices. The question is, which is your major and which is your minor? Most of us have a little essentialist and a little non-essentialist in us, but the question is, which are you at the core? People with essentialism at their core get far more from their investment than those who absorb it only at the surface level. Indeed, the benefits become cumulative. Every choice we make to pursue the essential and eliminate the non-essential builds on itself, making that choice more and more habitual until it becomes virtually second nature. With time, that inner core expands outwards until it has all but eclipsed the part of us still mired in the non-essential. It is easy to get caught up in the paradox of success we discussed in Chapter 1. We have clarity of purpose, which leads us to success, but with our success we get new options and opportunities. This sounds like a good thing, but remember, these options unintentionally distract us, tempt us, lure us away. Our clarity becomes clouded, and soon we find ourselves spread too thin. Now, instead of being utilized at our highest level of contribution, we make only a millimeter of progress in a million directions. Ultimately, our success becomes a catalyst for our failure. The only way out of this cycle is the way of the essentialist. But the way of the essentialist isn't just about success. It's about living a life of meaning and purpose. When we look back on our careers and our lives, would we rather see a long laundry list of accomplishments that don't really matter, or just a few major accomplishments that have real meaning and significance? If you allow yourself to fully embrace essentialism, to really live it, in everything you do, whether at home or at work, it can become a part of the way you see and understand the world. You can change your thinking so deeply that the practices of essentialism we have discussed and many others you will develop become natural and instinctive. As these ideas become emotionally true, they take on the power to change you. The Greeks had a word, metanoia, that refers to a transformation of the heart. We tend to think of transformations as happening only in the mind, but as the proverb goes, "As a man thinketh in his heart, so is he." Once the essence of essentialism enters our hearts, the way of the essentialist becomes who we are. We become a different, better version of ourselves. Once you become an essentialist, you will find that you aren't like everybody else. When other people are saying yes, you will find yourself saying no. When other people are doing, you will find yourself thinking. When other people are speaking, you will find yourself listening. When other people are in the spotlight, vying for attention, you will find yourself waiting on the sidelines until it is time to shine. While other people are padding their resumes and building out their LinkedIn profiles, you will be building a career of meaning. While other people are complaining, read bragging, about how busy they are, you will just be smiling sympathetically, unable to relate. While other people are living a life of stress and chaos, you will be living a life of impact and fulfillment. In many ways, to live as an essentialist in our too many things all the time society is an act of quiet revolution. Living fully as an essentialist isn't always easy. In many ways, I still struggle with it myself. I still instinctively want to please people when they ask me to do something, even something I know is non-essential. When presented with opportunities, especially good opportunities, I still fall into thinking I can do both, when I really can't. I still fight the urge to impulsively check my phone. On my worst days, I have wondered if my tombstone will read, "He checked email." I'll be the first to admit, the transition doesn't happen overnight. Still, over time, I have found it gets easier and easier. Saying no feels less uncomfortable. Decisions get much clearer. Eliminating the non-essentials becomes more natural and instinctive. I feel greater control of my choices to the point that my life is different. If you open your heart and mind to embrace essentialism fully, these things will become true for you as well. Today, essentialism is not just something I do. An essentialist is something I am steadily becoming. At first, it was a few deliberate choices. Then it grew into a lifestyle. And then it changed me, at my very core. I continue to discover almost daily that I can do less and less in order to contribute more. What being an essentialist means to me is best illustrated in the little moments. It means choosing to wrestle with my children on the trampoline instead of going to a networking event. Choosing to say no to international client work for the last year in order to write. Choosing to set aside a day each week where I don't check any social media so I can be fully present at home. Choosing to spend 8 months getting up at 5 a.m. every morning and writing till 1 p.m. in order to finish this book. Choosing to push back a work deadline in order to go camping with my children. Choosing not to watch any television or movies when I travel for business so there is time to think and rest. Choosing to regularly spend a whole day on that day's priority, even if it means doing nothing else on my to-do list. Choosing to put the novel I am reading on hold because it is not the priority today. Choosing to keep a journal almost every day for the last 10 years. Choosing to say no to a speaking opportunity in order to have a date night with Anna. Choosing to exchange time on Facebook for a regular call with my 93-year-old grandfather. Choosing to turn down a recent offer to be a lecturer at Stanford, since I knew it meant time away from spreading the message of essentialism through my lectures and being with family. The list goes on, but the point I want to make here is that focusing on the essentials is a choice. It is your choice. That in itself is incredibly liberating. Years ago, after I'd quit law school, I was deciding what to do next in my career. With Anna as my sounding board, I explored dozens, perhaps hundreds of different ideas. Then one day we were driving home and I said, "What if I went to Stanford for my graduate work?" There had been a lot of what-if questions like that. Usually, the ideas just didn't stick. But this time I felt a sense of immediate clarity. In that instant, I just knew, even as the words escaped my lips, that this was the essential path for me. What made me so sure I was on the right path was how the clarity disappeared when I even thought of applying elsewhere. Several times I started the application process for other programs, but always stopped after a few minutes. It just didn't feel right. So I concentrated my efforts only on that single application. As I waited to hear back from the university, many other opportunities, some quite tempting, presented themselves. I said no to all of them, but despite the uncertainty of not yet knowing whether I had been accepted, I didn't feel anxious or nervous. Instead, I felt calm, focused, and in control. I applied only to Stanford, both times. When I finally received my offer the second time around, it couldn't have been more clear to me that this was the most vital thing for me to be doing. It was the right path at the right time. It was the quiet, personal confirmation of the way of the essentialist. Had I not chosen the path of the essentialist, I might never have pursued the Stanford or bust strategy. I might never have written for Harvard Business Review, and I most certainly would never have written the words that you are now listening to, absorbing, and hopefully thinking hard about to integrate into your own life. Becoming an essentialist is a long process, but the benefits are endless. Here are some of the ways the disciplined pursuit of less can change your life for the better. More clarity. Remember the metaphorical closet we discussed in Chapter 1. As you continue to clear out the closet of your life, you will experience a reordering of what really matters. Life will become less about efficiently crossing off what was on your to-do list or rushing through everything on your schedule, and more about changing what you put on there in the first place. Every day it becomes more clear than the day before how the essential things are so much more important than the next most important thing in line. As a result, the execution of those essentials becomes more and more effortless. More control. You will gain confidence in your ability to pause, push back, or not rush in. You will feel less and less a function of other people's to-do lists and agendas. Remember that if you don't prioritize your life, someone else will. But if you are determined to prioritize your own life, you can. The power is yours. It is within you. More joy in the journey. With the focus on what is truly important right now comes the ability to live life more fully, in the moment. For me, a key benefit of being more present in the moment has been making joyful memories that would otherwise not exist. I smile more. I value simplicity. I am more joyful. As the Dalai Lama, another true essentialist, has said, "If one's life is simple, contentment has to come. Simplicity is extremely important for happiness." The essential life, living a life that really matters. The life of an essentialist is a life of meaning. It is a life that really matters. When I need a reminder of this, I think of a story. It is about a man whose 3-year-old daughter died. In his grief, he put together a video of her short little life. But as he went through all of his home videos, he realized something was missing. He had taken video of every outing they had gone on and every trip they had taken. He had lots of footage. That wasn't the problem. But then he realized that while he had plenty of footage of the places they had gone, the sights they had seen, the views they had enjoyed, the meals they had eaten, and the landmarks they had visited, he had almost no close-up footage of his daughter herself. He had been so busy recording the surroundings, he had failed to record what was essential. This story captures the two most personal learnings that have come to me on the long journey of writing this book. The first is the exquisitely important role of my family in my life. At the very, very end, everything else will fade into insignificance by comparison. The second is the pathetically tiny amount of time we have left of our lives. For me, this is not a depressing thought, but a thrilling one. It removes fear of choosing the wrong thing. It infuses courage into my bones. It challenges me to be even more selective about how to use this precious, and precious is perhaps too insipid of a word, time. I know of someone who visits cemeteries around the world when he travels. I thought this was odd at first, but now I realize that this habit keeps his own mortality front and center. The life of an essentialist is a life lived without regret. If you have correctly identified what really matters, if you invest your time and energy in it, then it is difficult to regret the choices you make. You become proud of the life you have chosen to live. Will you choose to live a life of purpose and meaning, or will you look back on your one single life with twinges of regret? If you take one thing away from this book, I hope you will remember this. Whatever decision or challenge or crossroads you face in your life, simply ask yourself, what is essential? Eliminate everything else. If you are ready to look inside yourself for the answer to this question, then you are ready to commit to the way of the essentialist. Appendix. Leadership Essentials. Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. Margaret Mead. LinkedIn CEO Jeff Weiner sees fewer things done better as the most powerful mechanism for leadership. When he took the reins of the company, he could easily have adopted the standard operating procedure of most Silicon Valley startups and tried to pursue everything. Instead, he said no to really good opportunities in order to pursue only the very best ones. He uses the acronym FCS, aka Focus, to teach his philosophy to his employees. The letters stand for fewer things done better. Communicating the right information to the right people at the right time, and speed and quality of decision making. Indeed, this is what it means to lead essentially. Essentialist teams. Essentialism as a way of thinking and acting is as relevant to the way we lead companies and teams as it is to the way we lead our lives. In fact, many of the ideas I have shared in this book first became clear to me in working with executive teams. I have since gathered data from more than 500 individuals about their experience on more than 1,000 teams. I asked them to answer a series of questions about a time when they had worked on a unified team, what the experience was like, what role their manager played, and what the end result was. Then I had them contrast this with a time when they had been on a disunified team, and what that was like, what role their manager played, and how it affected the end result. The results of this research were startling. When there was a high level of clarity of purpose, the teams and the people on it overwhelmingly thrived. When there was a serious lack of clarity about what the team stood for and what their goals and roles were, people experienced confusion, stress, frustration, and ultimately failure. As one senior vice president succinctly summarized it when she looked at the results gathered from her extended team, clarity equals success. This is just one of the many reasons that the principle of less but better is just as useful in building teams that can make a difference as it is in enabling individuals to live a life that really matters. Life on teams today is fast and full of opportunity. When teams are unified, the abundance of opportunity can be a good thing. But when teams lack clarity of purpose, it becomes difficult, if not impossible, to discern which of these myriad opportunities are truly vital. The unintended consequence is that non-essentialist managers try to have their teams pursue too many things, and try to do too many things themselves as well, and the team plateaus in its progress. An essentialist leader makes a different choice. With clarity of purpose, she is able to apply less but better to everything from talent selection to direction to roles to communication to accountability. As a result, her team becomes unified and breaks through to the next level. The elements of leading as an essentialist. At this point in the book, you've learned about flaws in non-essentialist thinking and replaced that false logic with the basic truths of essentialism. But essentialism doesn't end with the individual. If you lead in any capacity, whether it's a team of two colleagues, a department of 500 employees, or even some group in your school or community, the next step in your journey, if you are willing to take it, is to apply these same skills and mindsets to your leadership. Let's take a moment to briefly explore exactly how to lead as an essentialist. Be ridiculously selective in hiring people. A non-essentialist tends to hire people frantically and impulsively, then gets too busy or distracted to either dismiss or reskill the people keeping the team back. At first, the hiring bonanza seems justified because of the pace of growth that must be sustained. But in reality, one wrong hire is far costlier than being one person short. And the cost of hiring too many wrong people and one wrong hire often leads to multiple wrong hires because the wrong person will tend to attract more wrong people, is what Guy Kawasaki calls a bozo explosion, a term he uses to describe what happens when a formerly great team or company descends into mediocrity. An essentialist, on the other hand, is ridiculously selective on talent. She has the discipline to hold out for the perfect hire, no matter how many resumes she has to read, or interviews she has to conduct, or talent searches she has to make, and doesn't hesitate to remove people who hold the team back. The result is a team full of all-star performers whose collective efforts add up to more than the sum of their parts. See Chapter 9, Select, for more on this subject. Debate until you have established a really clear, not pretty clear, essential intent. Without clarity of purpose, non-essentialist leaders straddle their strategy. They try to pursue too many objectives, and do too many things. As a result, their teams get spread in a million directions and make little progress on any. They waste time on the non-essentials and neglect the things that really matter. See Chapter 10 on the importance of purpose and essential intent. These days, there is a lot of talk in organizations about alignment, and indeed, the more a team is aligned, the greater their contribution will be. Clear intent leads to alignment. Vague direction produces misalignment every time. Go for extreme empowerment. The non-essentialist disempowers people by allowing ambiguity over who is doing what. Often this is justified in the name of wanting to be a flexible or agile team. But what is actually created is a counterfeit agility. When people don't know what they are really responsible for and how they will be judged on their performance, when decisions either are or appear to be capricious and when roles are ill-defined, it isn't long before people either give up or, worse, become obsessed with trying to look busy and therefore important instead of actually getting any real work done. An essentialist understands that clarity is the key to empowerment. He doesn't allow roles to be general and vague. He ensures that everyone on the team is really clear about what they are expected to contribute and what everyone else is contributing. One CEO recently admitted that he had allowed ambiguity on his executive team to keep the whole organization back. To repair the damage, he said he went through a huge streamlining process until he was down to just 4 direct reports, each with a clear functional responsibility across the whole organization. The iconoclastic entrepreneur and venture capitalist Peter Thiel took less but better to an unorthodox level when he insisted that PayPal employees select one single priority in their role and focus on that exclusively. As PayPal executive Keith Raboy recalls, Peter required that everyone be tasked with exactly one priority. He would refuse to discuss virtually anything else with you except what was currently assigned as your number one initiative. Even our annual review forms in 2001 required each employee to identify their single most valuable contribution to the company. The result was the employees were empowered to do anything within the confines of that clearly defined role that they felt would make a high level of contribution to the shared mission of the company. Communicate the right things to the right people at the right time. The non-essentialist leader communicates in code, and as a result, people aren't sure what anything really means. Non-essentialist communication usually is either too general to be actionable, or changes so quickly that people are always caught off guard. Essentialist leaders, on the other hand, communicate the right things to the right people at the right time. Essentialist leaders speak succinctly, opting for restraint in their communication to keep the team focused. When they do speak, they are crystal clear. They eschew meaningless jargon, and their message is so consistent it seems almost boring to their ears. In this way, teams are able to pick up the essential through all the trivial noise. Check in often to ensure meaningful progress. The non-essentialist leader is not great on accountability. A primary and somewhat obvious reason is that the more items one pursues, the harder it is to follow up on all of them. In fact, a non-essentialist leader may unintentionally train his people to expect no follow-up at all. In turn, the members of the team soon learn that there are no repercussions for failing, cutting corners, or prioritizing what is easy over what is important. They learn that each objective pronounced by the leader will be emphasized only for a moment before giving way to something else of momentary interest. By taking the time to get clear about the one thing that is really required, the essentialist leader makes follow-up so easy and frictionless that it actually happens. By checking in with people frequently to reward small wins and help people remove obstacles, he bolsters the team's motivation and focus and enables them to make more meaningful progress. See Chapter 17 on the power of progress. Simply leading according to the principle of less but better will enable your team to amplify their level of collective contribution and achieve something truly remarkable. As expressed by Ella Behart, a classic essentialist and truly visionary leader whose legacy includes such meaningful achievements as winning the prestigious Indira Gandhi Prize for Peace, founding dozens of institutions dedicated to improving the conditions for poor women in India, and being named one of Hillary Clinton's personal heroines, out of all virtues, simplicity is my most favorite virtue. So much so that I tend to believe that simplicity can solve most of the problems, personal as well as the world problems. If the life approach is simple, one need not lie so frequently, nor quarrel, nor steal, nor envy, anger, abuse, kill. Everyone will have enough and plenty, so need not hoard, speculate, gamble, hate. When character is beautiful, you are beautiful. That is the beauty of simplicity. Indeed, that is the beauty of leading as an essentialist. This is Greg McEwen. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Essentialism, the Disciplined Pursuit of Less. This program was directed by Lisa Bainey, executive producer Aaron Blank. Text copyright 2014 by Greg McEwen. Production copyright 2014, Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.